Alma Alexio. Benvenuti ad Alma Alexio, il podcast dell'Università di Bologna dedicato alle Lectio Magistralis, tenute da scienziati, intellettuali e personaggi illustri che nel corso degli anni sono stati invitati dall'Università di Bologna a condividere il loro sapere e contribuire alla divulgazione della conoscenza. In questa nona puntata ascoltiamo Noam Chomsky, linguista, scienziato cognitivista, teorico della comunicazione e attivista politico. Gli universali della natura umana è il titolo della lezione dottorale tenuta il 1 aprile 2005 in occasione della cerimonia di conferimento della laurea d'onore in psicologia. Buon ascolto!
This is the kind of occasion that naturally leads one to think back over guiding issues of concerns and concerns of earlier years. In my personal case, that involves two almost parallel paths, almost parallel because they do converge short of infinity, though exactly how they converge is far from clear. One path seeks to understand more about language and mind. The other is guided by concerns for freedom and justice, and regrettably, human survival, not an idle concern in our era. There should be some shared elements, in particular what the co-founder of modern evolutionary theory, Alfred Russel Wallace, called man's intellectual and moral nature, the human capacity for creative imagination, language and symbolism generally, interpretation and recording of natural phenomena, intricate social practices and the like. It's a complex of capacities that seems to have crystallized fairly recently among a small group in East Africa, of which we are all descendants. The archaeological record suggests that the crystallization was so sudden in evolutionary time that some eminent scientists call the events the Great Leap Forward, which distinguished contemporary humans sharply from other animals, including other hominids. The principles of our intellectual and moral nature remain a considerable mystery, but we can hardly doubt their existence or their central role in our intellectual and moral lives. I'm aware that that's conventionally denied, but not credibly, in my opinion. These topics are far too broad to address, so I'd like to keep to two core aspects, human language, which is regarded by many paleoanthropologists as the factor that stimulated the Great Leap Forward, and our conception of fundamental human rights. In both domains, we should, I think, be looking for universals, that is, elements of our common human endowment that provide humans with specific cognitive capacities and with the foundations for moral judgment. There is a long and interesting history of thought about possible links between these domains, but they remain speculative and poorly understood. The only way to proceed, as far as I can see, is to say a few words about universality in language and in human rights, with barely a hint about the possible connections, a problem still very much on the horizon of inquiry. So to begin with, what about universality in language? The most productive way to approach the problem, I think, is within the framework of what has come to be called the biolinguistic perspective. It's an approach to language that began to take shape in the early 1950s, much influenced by recent developments in mathematics and biology. The approach interacted productively with a more general shift of perspective in the study of mental faculties, commonly called the cognitive revolution, though it would be more accurate, I think, to describe it as a second cognitive revolution, reviving and extending important insights and contributions of the cognitive revolution of the 17th and 18th century, which had regrettably been forgotten and are still very little known. In the 1950s, the study of language and mind was commonly considered part of the behavioral sciences. As the term indicates, the object of inquiry was taken to be behavior, and for linguistics, also its products, texts, perhaps a corpus elicited from native informants. Linguistic theory consisted of procedures of analysis, primarily segmentation and classification. Some of the most influential were those of Nikolai Trubetskoy and Zelig Harris. The procedures developed were guided by limited assumptions about structural properties and their arrangement. The prominent American theoretician Martin Jost hardly exaggerated in a 1955 exposition when he identified the decisive direction as the decision that language can be described without any pre-existent scheme of what a language must be. Prevailing approaches in the behavioral sciences generally were similar. No one, of course, believed in the incoherent notion of a blank slate, but it was common to suppose that some initial delimitation of properties detected in the environment, given those undifferentiated learning mechanisms of some kind, account for what organisms know and do, humans included. The biolinguistic approach, along with related areas of cognitive science, adopted a different stance. They took the object of inquiry to be not behavior and its products, but rather the internal systems that enter into action and interpretation, and at a deeper level, the basis in our biological nature for the growth and development of these internal systems. The goal was to discover what Juan Huarte in the 16th century described as the essential property of human intelligence, the capacity of the human mind to engender within itself by its own power the principles on which knowledge rests, ideas that were developed in important ways in the years that followed. For language, the principles on which knowledge rests are those of the internalized language, a certain cognitive state. I'll skip a few examples, which you have in the Italian translation. The general conclusion, I think, is that even the simplest human concepts appear to be entirely different from anything found in animal, symbolic, or communicative behavior. A significant problem for evolutionary theory, one of several. And the problems mount very rapidly when we move from words to expressions formed from them. One essential task of inquiry is to determine the principles on which such knowledge rests for the widest variety of possible human languages. A deeper problem is to discover what Huarte called the power to engender these principles of internal language. In current terms, that means the virtually uniform biological endowment that constitutes the human language faculty. The universal properties of language constitute, in effect, the genetic component of the language faculty. From this point of view, languages and other cognitive systems are taken to be, in effect, organs of the body, primarily the brain, to be investigated in the manner of other subcomponents that interact in the life of the organism, vision, motor planning, circulation of the blood, and others. Along with their role in behavior, the cognitive organs enter into activities traditionally regarded as mental, that's thought, planning, interpretation, evaluation, moral judgment, and so on. Behavior and its products, such as texts, provide data that may be useful as evidence in, to determine the nature and origins of cognitive systems, but they have no privileged status for such inquiries. One significant insight of the first cognitive revolution was that properties of the world that are called mental may involve unbounded capacities of a finite organ. That's the infinite use of finite means in the phrase of Wilhelm von Humboldt. In a rather similar vein, David Hume had recognized that our moral judgments are unbounded in scope and must be founded on general principles that are part of their nature, are part of our nature, although they are beyond what he called our original instincts. That observation poses Huarte's problem in a different domain where we might find a part of the thin thread that links the search for cognitive and moral universals. By the mid-20th century, it had become possible to face such problems in more substantive ways than before. By then, there was a clear understanding of finite generative systems with unbounded scope, which could be readily adapted to the reframing and investigation of some of the traditional questions that had necessarily been left obscure, though only some, it's important to stress. Humboldt referred to the infinite use of language, which is quite a different matter from the unbounded scope of finite means. Another influential factor in the renewal of the cognitive revolution in the 1950s was the work of ethologists, then just coming to be more widely known, with its concern for the innate working hypotheses present in subhuman organisms and the human a priori, which would have much the same character, Tinbergen and Lorentz in that case. This framework, too, could be adapted to the study of human human cognitive organs and their genetically determined nature, which constructs experience and guides the general path of development, as in other aspects of growth of organisms. Well, I will again skip some discussion of later developments to the present. The quest for principled explanation faces daunting tasks. We can formulate the goals with reasonable clarity. With each step towards the goal, we gain a clearer grasp of the universals of language. It should be kept in mind, however, that any such progress still leaves unresolved problems that have been raised for hundreds of years. Among these are the mysterious problems of the creative and coherent ordinary use of language, a core problem of Cartesian science, and on until today. Well, we're now moving to domains of will and choice and judgment, and the thin strands that make connect what seems within the range of scientific inquiry to essential problems of human life, in particular vexed questions about universal human rights. One possible way to draw connections is by proceeding along the lines of Hume's remarks, which I mentioned, his observation that the unbounded range of moral judgments must be founded on general principles that are part of our nature, although they are beyond our original instincts, which elsewhere he took to include quoting him, the species of natural instincts on which knowledge and belief are grounded. In recent years, there's been intriguing work in moral philosophy and experimental cognitive science that carries these ideas forward, investigating what seemed to be deep-seated moral intuitions, wrote an internal memo on pollution in which he demonstrated that the bank should be encouraging migration of polluting industries to the poorest countries. The reason, I apologize for the rhetoric, but this is quotation from technical economics, the reason is that the measurement of the costs of health-impairing pollution depends on the foregone earnings from increased morbidity and mortality, so it is rational for health-impairing pollution to be sent to the poorest countries where mortality is higher and wages are lowest. Other factors lead to the same conclusion. The fact that what he called aesthetic pollution concerns are more welfare-enhancing among the rich. People like us care about them more than poor people. He pointed out accurately that the logic of his memo is impeccable and that any moral reasons or social concerns that might be adduced could be turned around and used more or less effectively against every bank proposal for liberalization, so they cannot be relevant. The memo was leaked, and it led to a furious reaction, which was typified by Brazil's Secretary of the Environment, who wrote him a letter saying that his reasoning is perfectly logical but totally insane. The Brazilian minister was fired, while the author of the memo became Secretary of the Treasury under President Clinton and is now the president of Harvard University. The reaction was indeed furious, leading to evasions and denials that we can ignore. What is relevant here is the virtual unanimity of the moral judgment that the reasoning is logical but insane. That merits a closer look, now turning to the modern history of human rights doctrines. The standard codification of human rights in the modern period is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted in December 1948 by almost all nations, at least in principle. The Universal Declaration reflected a broad cross-cultural consensus. All of its components were taken to have equal status, from what are called anti-torture rights to socioeconomic rights, such as those enumerated in Article 25, which reads, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. These provisions have been reaffirmed in enabling conventions of the General Assembly and international agreements on the right to development in almost the same words. Well, it seems reasonably clear that this formulation of universal human rights rejects the impeccable logic of the chief economist of the World Bank, if not as insane, at least as profoundly immoral, which was, in fact, the virtually universal judgment, at least of those willing to appear in public. It's important, however, to stress the word virtually. As is well known, Western culture condemns some nations as relativists who interpret the Universal Declaration selectively. rejecting components that they do not like. And there has been great indignation about the so-called Asian relativists or the unspeakable communists who descend to this degraded practice. Less noticed is that the leader of the relativist camp is the leader of the self-designated enlightened states, the world's most powerful state. We see examples daily, although see is perhaps the wrong word, since we see them but do not notice them. I'll keep to the United States, but that's misleading. It may sometimes be a few steps ahead of the Western world in these respects, but there's in fact very little difference apart from distribution of power. A month ago, the press featured lead stories about the release of the State Department's annual report on human rights around the world. The spokesperson at the news conference was Paula Dobriansky, who is Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. And she affirmed, in her words, that promoting human rights is not just an element of our foreign policy, it is the bedrock of our policy and our foremost concern. There is, however, a bit more to the story. Dobriansky was Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. And in that capacity, she sought to dispel what she called myths about human rights, the most salient being the myth that so-called economic and social rights constitute human rights. She denounced the effort to obfuscate human rights discourse by introducing these spurious rights, which are entrenched in the Universal Declaration, formulated at U.S. initiative, but which the U.S. government explicitly rejects, and increasingly the entire West, within the framework of the neoliberal doctrines on which the chief economist of the World Bank was relying. I should stress that it is the U.S. government that rejects these provisions of the Universal Declaration. The American population strongly disagrees. One current illustration is the federal budget, which was announced last month, along with a study of public reactions to it carried out by the world's most prestigious institution for the study of public opinion. The public calls for sharp cuts in military spending, along with sharply increased social spending. That means education, medical research, job training, conservation, renewable energy, as well as increased spending for the United Nations and for economic and humanitarian aid, and also calls for a reversal of Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy. Government policy is dramatically the opposite in every respect. Studies of public opinion, which regularly demonstrate this very sharp divide between policy and public opinion, these are rarely even reported, so the public is not only removed from the arena of policy formation, but is also largely kept unaware of public opinion. There is, rightly, much international concern about the consequence of the rapidly expanding twin deficits in the United States. It means the trade and the budget deficit. Closely related is a third deficit, the growing democratic deficit, not just in the United States, but in the West generally. That is not discussed because it's welcomed by wealth and power, which have every reason to want the public to be largely removed from policy choices and implementation, a matter that should be of considerable concern, quite apart from its relation to the universality of human rights. It's depressingly easy to add many more examples, ranging across the full spectrum of rights affirmed in the Universal Declaration. And they teach us about two important topics, universal moral judgments and the elite moral and intellectual culture in which we live, which dramatically and forcefully rejects them. I'll end with a few observations on the current scene. We have just passed the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero of El Salvador, who was called a voice for the voiceless, and also the 15th anniversary of the murder of six leading Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests. These two events frame the hideous decade of the 1980s in Central America. Archbishop Romero and the Jesuit intellectuals were murdered by security forces armed and trained by Washington, in fact, by the present incumbents or their immediate mentors. And the same is true of most of the hundreds of thousands of other victims. The Archbishop was assassinated while he was performing Mass shortly after he wrote to President Carter, pleading with him not to send aid to the brutal military junta in El Salvador, which the Archbishop wrote, will sharpen the repression that has been unleashed against the people's organizations fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights. State terror escalated, always with U.S. support and Western silence and complicity. If anything remotely similar had happened in Eastern Europe in those years, the events would be known and the anniversaries commemorated, assuming, that is, that outrage had not led as far as nuclear war. The differentiating principle is crystal clear and is probably close to a historical universal. For the powerful, our own crimes do not exist. We must not remember the grim fate of those who were fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights, nor should we remember who bears responsibility for these atrocities. In societies that value their freedom, it would be unnecessary to recount any of this because it would be taught in schools and well known to everyone. And the same would be true of the continuing atrocities taking place right now by military forces armed and trained by Washington with the support of its Western allies. For example, in Colombia, which is the leading human rights violator in the hemisphere, and for many years, the leading recipient of U.S. military aid and training. The State Department reports that last year, Colombia retained its record of killing more labor activists than the rest of the world combined. A few weeks ago, the military broke into the first and the most important of the towns that had declared themselves to be zones of peace, murdering one of its founders and others, including children aged 2 and 6. Little is known about these matters, apart from the circles of people who really are devoted to defending universal human rights. Well, I mentioned these few examples to remind ourselves that we are not merely engaged in seminars on abstract principles or discussing remote cultures that we do not understand. We're speaking of ourselves and the moral and intellectual values of the privileged elite communities in which we live. And if we do not like what we see when we look in the mirror honestly, we have every opportunity to do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Avete ascoltato la lezione dottorale tenuta da Noam Chomsky il 1 aprile 2005 presso l'Alma Mater Studiorum Università di Bologna. Vi aspettiamo alla prossima Alma Lexio.